It's blazing hot outside. You get in your car to turn on the AC to get cold air pumping, but it blows hot air out. This issue is commonly caused by low refrigerant due to leaks in the AC system. You want an easy, all-in-one solution that will restore the cold air in no time. AC Pro Recharge Kits make restoring cold air easy for even those with zero DIY experience in less than 10 minutes. Save time and money versus going to a shop by picking up an AC Pro Recharge Kit today. Be a pro with AC Pro.
Hello, everybody. This is Jim Callis, part of the MLB Pipeline Podcast with Jonathan Mayo. We have a pinch hitter this weekend, the esteemed Sam Dykstra, the third member of our prospect ranking team at Pipeline. Jason Ratliff has fled the country. He's in Paris, so he's not joining us on the podcast, which is just terrible, but we'll cut him some slack. And we're going to start off today a little different than we normally do by celebrating one of our own, Mr. Jonathan Mayo.
Well, shucks.
25 years of MLB service, MLB.com service. Congratulations, Jonathan. Pretty cool deal. Tell everybody what you win when you've worked 25 years at MLB.com.
The pride and satisfaction of having worked this long. No.
25 years of salary is what you win.
Yeah, that's right. I get what is sort of euphemistically, no, it's not a euphemism. It's called the Golden Pass. And it is not to get me into the Wonka Factory, although that would be cool too. It is a lifetime pass to any major league ballpark for myself and a guest. Forever and ever. I'm looking at it right now, and it comes in this nice little leather case, and I open it, and it literally goes, oh, every time I open it.
It's like Pulp Fiction. Is that what was in the briefcase diner in Pulp Fiction?
That's exactly right. That is outstanding, and I really wish I had thought of that when it was presented to me. Jim, you just won the day with that one. It is really quite something and very surreal. That I've been here for that long. Before joining MLB.com, like a lot of young people in journalism, I had a whole bunch of different jobs and kind of just thought that's what I'd end up doing. And way back in April of 1999, Christine DiStefano took a chance on me. I was the first ever staff writer, a full-time staff writer for MLB.com. And, they haven't been able to get rid of me since. So this is the culmination of being very, very lucky.
I want to know if she was singing the ABBA song, Take a Chance on Me, or you were when you got hired
yes.
Back in 1999.
Yes, it was.
Do you happen to know how many people still at MLB.com have been working there longer than you have? Are there any?
None.
Wow.
I am now the would be considered the number one employee because I started working before MLB.com as we know it. It was, you know, MajorLeagueBaseball.com. We were a staff of four, I think, then. Now, there are some people who worked for teams that joined Major League Baseball, I think. And I think there might be a couple who work for the site who fit that bill, but not that I'm aware of. But in terms of working specifically for Major League Baseball's website, no one predates me.
Some point along the line, you guys decided to, or you got the opportunity to switch to minor league coverage and hone in on prospects and really build out, you know, the bones of what became MLB Pipeline and what we do every day now. Like, kind of take people through that process.
No, don't blame me. My first couple of years, I was a national writer and I did major league coverage and got to do some cool stuff and went to Japan for the Mets Cubs opening series in 2000. That was the first of those. And then in 2003 is when I kind of switched gears. I always liked doing prospect stuff. You know, I was at the first Futures game at Fenway Park in 1999. And we did a lot of that. And I learned that first year in 99 that the draft and the internet was a big deal. I mean, all it was we broadcast the conference call, but we would set traffic records based on that and written coverage. So that's kind of was the foundation. And in 2003, I was feeling a little restless and needed to change. And we didn't really have anybody who was dedicated to the prospect coverage. And I saw what people like Jim Callis was doing at Baseball America, and they were kind of the standard bearer. And I said, well, I think there's room for more of that. And I kind of switched in 2003 to just covering prospects and built from there. 2004 was the first time we ever did any kind of prospect rankings. As we've kind of talked a lot about this year, you know, Joe Mauer was our first ever number one prospect, and now he's a Hall of Famer, which is kind of another stroke of good luck. Then we sort of switched over in 2005. And for a few years, my stuff was on the minor league website, the new minorleaguebaseball.com, milb.com, and we helped build that out. And then in 2008, we kind of switched over back over to MLB.com, but still doing the same kind of prospect coverage, rankings, draft coverage, things of that nature. And that led to what we now know as MLB Pipeline. And I think, you know, there are so many things I could point to that I'm proud of, but especially in terms of the draft, we started doing live video. I want to say it was in 2006. No, it was probably earlier than that. I think it may have even been in 2004 that we started really doing live video. We had some, you know, like with a lot of things in the internet, we did things wrong until we did it right. Yeah, I remember in 2004 vividly doing live video call of the draft, and someone was giving me the names in my ear, and then I would announce it, and someone in my ear told me that David Bailey had been drafted number 7 overall by the Cincinnati Reds. And while I was not doing the amount of prep as we do now, and I didn't have anyone else as my wingman or wingmen with like the two of you, I had done a fair amount of work. And I'm like, who is David Bailey and why is he going so high? Now, that turned out that was Homer Bailey, who I knew all about, but I had no idea who that was. I'm really proud. I bring that up just because that was sort of the precursor to the draft being on TV, first on ESPN in 2007 and 2008, and then on MLB Network since, to have been a part of sort of the beginning stages of all sorts of prospect coverage and the proliferation of that is definitely a proud achievement for me.
And Jonathan, I don't know if it's your favorite story. It's got to be one of your favorite stories because you've talked about a number of times over the years, but tell everybody about how you've come. I don't know if it's full circle because it's 20 years later, not 25 years later, but a story you did in 2004 that you're now, it's linked to a story that you're busily working on, perhaps completed right before we began the podcast.
Just completed. And yes, and it does tie together because Jason Ratliff, who you mentioned, is not here, kind of tied the presentation of my Golden Pass and 25-year anniversary on this trip. So I went to Washington, D.C. for Justin Verlander's first start of the year, which may not make sense. We're not in the business of covering 41-year-olds very often. But 20 years ago, I went to Norfolk, Virginia for a draft story, and I hadn't done much traveling for draft stuff. The year before, I had gone to Eastern Pennsylvania to do a story on Chris Lebanski, who was the number 5 overall pick in the draft, and unfortunately never made it to the big leagues, but was such a great kid and a great, you know, I guess not so young man now. But in 2004, I went to Norfolk because there was going to be this huge college pitching matchup between Justin Verlander and Justin Orenduff. And the two of them had been teammates on Team USA on an absolutely ridiculous pitching staff that also included Jared Weaver. Houston Street was the closer. And the two of them both pitched very well. And they were the Friday night stars for Old Dominion and Virginia Commonwealth. Verlander had already kind of established himself as a top of the first round guy. Orndorff was being talked about as maybe a late first round guy. He ended up going in the sandwich round. And it was one of those times, you guys have all seen, you get excited about a matchup, pitching matchup, and you go and it ends up being 15 to 12 and both guys get bounced in the third inning, that sort of thing. This lived up to advanced billing in that Orndorff struck out 11 and lost 3-0. Verlander struck out 16. It was a complete game shutout. He was absolutely ridiculously in control, and there must have been 100 scouts on hand. And so I interviewed the two of them the day after to sort of talk about their relationship, the rivalry, and what that game was like, and wrote a story that is impossible to find. The internet, things that were on the internet in 2004, it's tough. So I never could find it. But so we went back, and I've stayed in touch with Justin Orndorff over the years. He now he founded a company that analyzes pitching deliveries and mechanics to try to predict and avoid injuries, because his career was derailed by injuries. And he actually has become a sounding board for Verlander over the last 10 years or so. And I got to hang out with the two of them after Verlander started on Friday, by the way, in which he went six innings and got the win, to kind of reminisce about that start 20 years ago and talk about the relationship that they've forged since.
Well, that's pretty cool. And Jason, who presented you with your gold pass?
Well, so I kind of ended up in thanking both of them, but particularly Verlander, who is certainly a guy who doesn't mind talking, but is not, he's a pretty private person for taking so much extra time out, and his parents were in town, and to do this, I said it was a bit of a full circle moment, and then, unbeknownst to me, Jason had been carrying around the gold pass and the letter from the commissioner commending me on my 25 years of service. And he said, speaking of coming full circle, he thought it was fitting to have the longest tenured player in the big leagues currently kind of officially present the pass and the letter to me. And he had it in his hand, and I was rendered speechless. It was really an unbelievable moment. And the funny thing is, as sneaky as Jason is, earlier in the day, I was saying that it was telling me, it had dawned on me that, in addition to this, kind of being cool to get to do this 20 years later, that the timing was unbelievable, because I was coming up on my 25th anniversary, which was officially on April the 21st. This was April the 19th when we got together, and he just played it off. He's like, "Oh, really? I knew it was coming up, but I didn't know exactly when it was." Meanwhile, the golden pass was burning a hole in his backpack, and so he played that off quite coolly, as you can imagine he would, and then created a moment for me that I will remember forever.
No, very, very cool. Sam, how long have you worked at MLB or MILB? I guess you started with MILB.com, but how long have you been under the MLB Advanced Media umbrella?
Yeah, I started in March 2012. So this is my 13th season covering minor league baseball in one way or another. So
halfway there. Cool.
Yeah, I'm halfway. I know, right? Yeah, it's within reach, I guess. But
I don't know if I'm going to get to mine. You're going to beat me there, because I started in September 2013, and I will thank Jonathan, because I would not have taken the job if it had not been for his just very well done recruiting, where it wasn't over the top, where he was showering me with Lamborghinis or flowers or anything, but
Jonathan, just the one Lamborghini.
Just the one Lamborghini.
Filled with flowers.
My wife is still upset she didn't get one. But no, Jonathan was very – Jonathan kind of opened the door for me. And then the recruiting process was mercurial, might be a good word to describe it. And Jonathan was filling in blanks that perhaps others should have filled in. And I'm very grateful. So thank you for that, Jonathan. And, we'll have to – I'll ask you guys. I don't know if I'll get my gold pass, because I would be 71 when I would be at 25 years of service. I don't know. Do you think I get my gold pass? Do you think I retire before then?
I want you to work until as long as you want, Jim. So it sounded 71 sounds great to me personally. I don't know about you.
I just watched Justin Verlander at 41 pitch and talk about pitching into his 40s. So why not? And I mean, I think Ann's going to want you to be doing something with your time. So you might as well, you might as well stay employed.
Yeah, maybe. So we'll see about that. Well, I mean, I can't wait. I it just seems a long way off. Like, well, because we're on the day we're trying to get the draft top 150 all but done.
Yeah.
And it's like 15 more years seems like a very long time.
Yes.
We shall see. I predict Sam Dykstra will get his gold pass. I don't know what the odds are of me getting it. We'll see what DraftKings comes up with.
If I get my gold pass, Jim, you can be my plus one forever. How about that?
Jason will still be working for MLB.com.
Well, that's true.
And he'll have me come out of retirement to surprise you with your gold pass. And see, the cool thing is, I guess it wouldn't be a 20th anniversary, but you two are working on a cool story that maybe we will revisit 15 years down the line. So tell us what you worked on this week. Before we do that real quick, Jonathan, when is your story on the update, the retrospective?
The Justins.
Yes.
It will be up. We're recording on Tuesday morning. It will be up Tuesday night into Wednesday.
Oh, very nice. So people look for that. It may be out probably by the time you're hearing this.
Yep.
And then Sam just worked on a cool story, which is already on our website. So Sam, tell us what that was and how that came about.
Yeah. So last week, one of our editors reached out to me and said, would you like to go to Indianapolis? Because Paul Skeens is pitching on Thursday and who knows how many minor league starts he has left. I mean, we have an idea that now it's at least a couple still, because he's still topped out at 3 1/3 innings, but he is adding pitches and we want to get him while he's hot. And we wanted somebody to get eyes on him and talk to him about his arsenal, because as you guys know, and probably many of our listeners know, AAA has Statcast data, but it's for pitchers like Skeens, it's not always clean, right? There's some pitches that cause some confusion. Is that a cutter? Is that a slider? For him in particular, and Jonathan, you've been on this since the beginning, is it a splinker? what is that pitch he's throwing?
I don't know. It should be illegal is what it is.
Yeah, it's a Yoan Duran splinker style. He calls it a sinker. The pitching coach calls it a splinker. Henry Davis was trying to tell reporters, look out for this pitch. It's a splinker. I'm calling it a splinker. It acts like a sinker. It's got the spin rate of a splitter. It's in the mid-90s. I think it's averaging 95 miles an hour. It's just absolutely disgusting. And then you pair that with, you know, his fastball that, as everybody knows, touches 102 so far this season. At the time I wrote this story, he had more 100-plus mile-an-hour pitches than anybody else in AAA, and he was, like, lapping the field. He had 74. Number two was Justin Martinez of the D-backs with 24. And this is just in limited starts. If he was throwing 5-6 innings, he would have been in triple digits, no problem. So it was good to get him on the record about all this stuff, because, you know, we can look at the data, we can watch the video, we can talk to coaches, but it's great to get it from the horse's mouth in this case. So talking to him about his fastball, and he said, there's no magic to it. I'm just big, I'm strong, I'm efficient. That's where it comes from. I'm not trying to get 103. It comes out that way. I do throw hard. I know that I can blow it past guys. The interesting thing about the fastball to me was there has been some concern in some circles about, like, the pitch shape, that it doesn't have the right induced vertical break. It doesn't rise the right way. He said he doesn't concern himself with that. He knows the velocity is good enough. He's not getting too wrapped up in the data in that way. He's much more reliant on his eyes. And when you're blowing it past AAA batters, it's clearly working in pro ball. So he's not going to start fixing his fastball just to add a few inches of IVB just for the heck of it. So that was really illuminating. The slider, you look at the data on that. Sometimes it's got sweep like 16 inches. Sometimes it's got sweep that's actually going arm side. It acts more like a cutter, but he's always throwing it like a slider. They're not two different pitches. So that was good to get him on the record about that. We talked about the splinker. He says you can call it whatever you want. So I'm going to go with splinker just because it is such a unique pitch. He's got a changeup. That is a true changeup. That means that splitter sinker hybrid is not his changeup, even though some systems mark it as a changeup. And then he's got a curveball for the heck of it too. Like that, it's a full 5-pitch arsenal that he's using right now at AAA to get batters out. He would probably be relying on all 5 pitches if he was going deeper into games. We haven't seen too much of the curveball to this point, but because the fastball has been really good, the slider's been arguably even better at getting whiffs, and he can just throw in that splinker whenever he wants. Like, by the time he gets to Pittsburgh, which should be very soon, it feels like, it's a major league arsenal on day one. And we're already seeing what Jared Jones is doing for the Pirates and how good he's been. We're talking one day after he dominated the Brewers. Having those two guys, 1-2, it's been a, Jonathan, you can speak to this. Like, it's been a nice start in Pittsburgh. It's going to be a lot nicer the day Paul Skene shows up.
Yeah, maybe he could hit. That's the one thing.
He can hit.
I know. That's why I said that.
I thought you were, I mean, I know you know his background. I thought you were lamenting, but like.
No. Like, why maybe not? He could just be in, him, put him in the lineup. That's what I'm saying.
Throw him in at DH. There
yeah,
you go.
Yeah. On the days when they want to rest McCutcheon, the scoring run's been an issue. Maybe they should call that pitch just the stat cast breaker. Because I think it's just like they don't know what to. It misidentifies it so often, but it has been, yeah, the only thing is we haven't seen enough of him. And I know he is starting Wednesday, tomorrow, as we're recording this in Omaha. And I think the hope is to get him up to 75 to 80 pitches. The Pirates keep joking with me, guys, that he's just striking out too many guys. So he can't, they were kind of hoping that maybe he could get through five. But it's not like he's running super deep counts, but you strike guys out, you're going to run deeper counts than pitching to contact in the first or, so he's got to miss fewer bats so he can get to, out to the sort of five innings that people want to see before he gets called up.
Well, it worked once. I'm going to try to work my magic again, after I assailed poor Tony Kemp and just questioned why Jackson Holliday wasn't in the big leagues and he's gotten off to a slow start. I get that you're trying to build him up slowly and manage his innings. It's his first full season in pro ball. Let's have Paul Skene pitch 3 1/3 innings in Pittsburgh. Like those innings would help. I don't get it.
I was having this conversation with people recently, and they could have had him up from opening day, limited him to 90 pitches. I understand originally, especially because he was a little behind because he got sick, but like he could make 30 starts at five innings a pop in the big leagues, and you're still limiting him to 150 innings, which seems like a good step forward after he threw about 120 something last year. You're still monitoring what he can do.
Right.
But it's going to happen sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and one thing I'll bring up, too, is talking to him after his start on Thursday, which is not part of this conversation you guys are about to hear, but on Thursday, talking to him and just being like, so what was your reaction coming out after 3 1/3? Your manager comes out, and he was like, I'm frustrated, to be honest with you. It's over my head. It's over his head. I'm not frustrated at him. I want to pitch. And I think the Pirates want a guy who wants to pitch. Like, they want him to be frustrated a little. They don't want him to be comfortable getting taken out of a game, because that's a mindset that – they want pitching in September and October and all that kind of stuff. So to his credit, he's not like just sitting idly by and accepting what's going on. He wants to be out there as much as everybody else wants.
Well, good. And so let's listen to the man himself tell you all about it. We're going to take a break for a moment. And when we return, Sam will have his interview with the best pitching prospect in baseball, Paul Skene, who I believe, guys, is our highest ranked prospect who's in the minors. Also, not just the best pitching prospect in baseball, but that'll be coming up next on the MLB Pipeline Podcast. Welcome back to the Pipeline Podcast. We were right before the break setting up Sam's interview with Paul Skene, and it's great stuff. Best pitching prospect in baseball explains how he throws what he throws and how it works and his philosophy. It's tremendous stuff. So let's take a listen to Sam talking to Paul Skene here.
You were talking about last night when we were talking about ABS and your history as a catcher. How do you feel like that's helped you in terms of determining pitch sequencing and usage?
A ton. And I think part of it is I just have a mind for getting hitters out beating pitchers. That's why I'm not hitting anymore. So.
Right.
But yeah, I was lucky enough to come out game when I was at Air Force. So we were, digesting scouting reports and that kind of thing. And then, obviously catering it to who's pitching. Which has been cool, and now I'm kind of on the other side of that more. So, I mean, I was pitching the whole time when I was at Air Force and LSU, obviously, but now I'm, completely on the other side, and So I was able to learn a lot through catching about how to get hitters up.
In that calling game aspect, was that something they gave you immediately, or is that something they had to warm up to you?
Yeah, no. Well, you gotta. I mean, everyone does it kind of throughout the fall, and then you know I earned it basically. Mm-hmm. And you know, our coaches would like to say that it's a leadership opportunity. You know, which is you know what they're doing more so than making baseball players. They're developing leaders. So. Working with pitchers, figuring out, you know, a plan and that kind of thing. That's all leadership. So that was kind of the mindset of it. Also to, you know, that was their philosophy in terms of getting hitters out too. But, as soon as I started catching there, I pretty much had free reign over that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and how's your approach changed as a pitcher from high school to the Air Force to LSU to even now?
It's just gotten more self-awareness for sure. Obviously, as I've gotten better, my plan has had to change. And throughout that, I'm just trying, everything I'm shooting for is just self-awareness in terms of how my stuff is going to play to get hitters out. And that, you know, not just in terms of pitch sequencing and that kind of thing, but like my body, you know, strength conditioning, like everything is just self-awareness, in my opinion. So that's what I'm shooting for.
Yeah, and when did that moment of self-awareness kick in to where you are now, where it's the fastball that's playing, it's the slider, you know?
I don't know. I don't know if it... Because I think it's more of an evolving thing rather than just, you know, wake up one day and I have it figured out. Because, you know, hopefully in 2 weeks I'm going to be better than I am today. And, you know, today I feel like I'm better than I was 2 weeks ago, too. So, yeah. And so as I go throughout that, it's always evolving, it's always changing, and I think just being aware of that is the biggest thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and speaking of that evolution, how do you feel like you're different as a pitcher from the day you were drafted with the Pirates' guidance and coaching?
Self-awareness. I think just knowing how my stuff plays against big league hitters, or against professional hitters is the biggest thing. Because mm-hmm. The stuff hasn't changed a ton. The sinker's changed a little bit, but the stuff hasn't changed a whole lot, and it's just... I think just being able to command and attack the zone, like more so like just learning how to pitch rather than changing anything that I need to do. So
yeah, you mentioned the sinker. How has it changed? Do you feel it?
So it was the cue that I didn't throw it a ton during the season last year in college, yeah. Because you know on the self awareness thing, it was going to get beat just because it was a bad speed pitch a little bit, like to go inside to righties with metal bats, like it wasn't going to play. So. But I was getting it off my middle finger in college, and then I started playing around with it kind of leading into the draft, right after the draft, when I was at home, and I was I just felt it off my index finger. So it is a different pitch than I was throwing it in college last year. So, but that was something that I started doing really when I got to pro ball, just because it just so happened that I figured it out between college and pro ball. It's not anything that, you know, not a magic switch that like flipped or anything like that. So, but yeah, I've just been, you know, ripping it out really.
Yeah. So is that just like a feel thing going from the middle finger to the index finger? I mean, or did that happen by accident? How did that?
Yeah, it happened by accident, and then it became a conscious thing to, you know, get it off that finger. More so, and you know, you watch Edge video, like it still comes off the middle finger last, but the feel for me and the thought is to get it off the index finger. So that was something I felt, like I said, between the College World Series and the draft, and I just kept repping it out, and then you know, now I kind of know what I need to do to get the shape and command over it and when to throw it and that kind of thing. That's what I've been, you know, shooting to do.
Yeah, and speaking of thought process, you're calling it a sinker. Some people are calling it a splinker. What is your thought process, just sinker the entire time you're throwing it?
Yeah, I mean, it's just tough to scout for a little bit. And I think that's why they started calling it a splinker a little bit, is because it's not like any other sinker. Mm-hmm. And it's not like a splitter, really. Like, it's a hybrid pitch. So, because it doesn't have true, you know, it doesn't have a true sinker profile. Like, they're calling it changeup they're tagging it as changeup on the system that we use, like that kind of thing. It's not a changeup.
Right.
There's obviously a velo difference, and then I have a true changeup too. But, yeah, you call it whatever you want. I call it a sinker it plays differently than any other sinker, and it plays differently than any other splitter. That's all I can.
Have you ever tried to come up with a special name for it?
I let other people. Henry,
not the Skeens or something like that.
No, Henry started calling it the Splinker.
Right, right.
I'll let him do that.
Yeah, fair enough. And I was looking at the data last night on your sliders. You were talking too about manipulating. Sometimes it was like 3 inches of sweep. Sometimes it was 16. What goes into the thought process of how to manipulate it when you're going to the shorter slider versus the longer one?
Just feel a little bit the situation. I couldn't tell you exactly what it is, but or if there is there, because there's no like end all be all in situations where like, yeah, this guy's up this count, I'm always going to throw the short one, always going to throw the big one. It's just a feel thing too. Mm-hmm. So and just letting my stuff play.
How are you? Is it in the grip? Is it in the way you're throwing it?
It's just feel.
Yeah.
And I couldn't tell you exactly what it is. It's just feel. I just know what the short one feels like, what the big one feels like.
Mm-hmm. So are you just looking based on results? Are you looking at like scouting reports on when to throw it? I know you're talking about feel a lot, but how much does prep go into whether you're going to start with the shorter one versus the longer one?
Kind of all of it, with scouting reports and that kind of thing, and then just how I feel.
Yeah.
I'm a super feel driven guy, so the situation, just how my body feels, that kind of thing.
No, totally. And we were talking last night about your changeup. I noticed one thing is some of them were like the slowest changeups you've thrown so far. Was that killing even more speed on it? Was that a point of emphasis last night?
I didn't know that.
Oh, okay.
To be honest, so okay. Yeah, I don't know.
All right, no, fair enough. And you were saying you've thrown it all since high school, basically. How has the pitch changed at all?
I don't think it has a ton. That's been a pitch that I've had. Because when I was 10 or 11 learning how to pitch, like it was fastball changeup, and so I developed the feel for it then. It's a different pitch now. But the grip that I have now, I started throwing when I was like sophomore or junior in high school or something like that, and I've just kept it the same throughout that. And so it's just a total feel pitch, and I'm super confident with it because I didn't really have a slider my freshman or sophomore year at Air Force, and I was fastball changeup, as a closer. And so that, just relying on that, it's just something that, I'm super confident with.
Yeah, and I saw some video of it. It looked like a Vulcan-style grip. Is that how you would describe it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't... It's a changeup for me. I'm just trying to feel about my middle finger off the seam, so that's all I really care about.
Yeah, I mean, you were saying you were throwing that a lot, if you were fastball changeup to start. Was that somebody giving you guidance of, you're too young to throw a breaking ball, focus on these two?
Probably, but then I also, I'm so pronation biased, it was really tough for me to find a breaking ball until I started throwing hard, frankly. My hand sped up, and that allowed me to start throwing a breaking ball that I throw now, because I can get off my fingers the right way. So, but until then, it wasn't a consistent breaking ball. So even when I was old enough to throw a breaking ball, it was pretty much always fastball changeup and then try to figure out something that moves left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when do you feel like that really locked in, that this slider is now my best, my second best pitch?
Probably last year at some point, but I was fooling around with a lot of different breaking pitches before then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and speaking of which, you're throwing a curveball as well. How do you feel like those two differentiate, and how does that give you a fourth weapon, basically?
Yeah, I mean, it's just a different shape. And I started throwing that during the season last year, probably the fourth or fifth week of the season in college, and I don't think guys had it on their report, because the first time it literally got touched was in the SEC tournament. I think it was a foul ball or something like that.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
It was always a take pitch or a swing and miss pitch, and now it's a little bit different because they have it in the report, but it's just a different shape. It's more of a hump versus more of a flat spin, and some guys see the curveball better, some guys see the slider better.
Yeah, and speaking of being a guy who's going off feel and going off reaction, what do you feel like is the silliest reaction you've seen to any of your pitches so far this season?
Just swords. In general. those are just fun to watch.
Are you somebody who keeps track of the amount of swords you have as the season goes along?
No.
Okay.
I'll let everybody else do that.
Yeah, but you just file it away for that got the reaction I was looking for. Okay, fair enough. And how does your approach just kind of change when, last year, you were going 120 pitches? Now they're probably going to pull you into 50, 60 like they have so far. Do you pitch any differently? Throw harder when you know it's an abbreviated start? How do you approach that?
I think more so I'm just trying to figure out what I need to do to get professional hitters out efficiently, because that's always the goal. I just had a little bit longer leash in college just because I was throwing less frequently. And, I mean, I could do it. You know, I showed that I could do it last year. So that's why they let me go so long. But that's obviously not going to be the case now. The difference, I think, is the hitters is just trying to get them out as efficiently as possible. So, you know, some adjustments that I've made and going to have to continue to make. So,
yeah, and one thing we haven't touched on yet is the fastball, because everybody knows about the fastball. But how would you describe what your power source is in getting to the point where you are throwing 101, 102?
I mean, just being strong, moving efficiently. Like, and it's not a, you know, it's not magic. It's just you gotta, like, it works for me. Other guys do it differently, but that's kind of my bread and butter, is just being strong and moving efficiently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know you're not a huge guy who's looking at rise and stuff like that, but your rise being where it is, you're still pretty efficient with the fastball. What do you attribute that to? Is it just the velocity? Is it extension? How do you feel like you get the fastball to play out?
Yeah, I have no idea. And I don't, I laugh when people talk about, you know, extension, you know, induced vertical break and stuff like that, because it helps you quantify it a little bit, but like quantify why a guy is good or why a guy is bad, maybe, but or why that pitch plays well or doesn't play well or something like that. But I think the eyes kind of are the biggest thing. That's kind of, I don't look at my shapes a ton unless I find something that is drastically wrong in how I'm moving with my body, and then I might look at the shapes for. You know, because the body is going to affect how the ball comes out of the hand too. So I might look at the shapes there. But yeah, I just laugh when people talk about, you know, because the plot is the end all be all. Like, I just laugh.
Yeah, no, totally, I get it. Speaking of positioning and all that, I've noticed you move around the mound a little bit. Is that something that started last year?
Yeah, and that was another thing we started doing during the season last year. Basically just thought I could do it, and, you know, with my angle of my arm being, you know, crossfire a little bit too, right, like, just thought it would be funky and help me tunnel a little bit better against each side of the plate if I switch. So played around with it, and that's kind of something that I continue to do.
Yeah, where were you positioned before, like, when you were in Air Force?
I think when I was at Air Force, I think it was third base side, and then I think I switched to the first base side.
Okay.
At LSU, and then I started switching.
Okay. Yeah, and what do you feel like that does, especially against righties?
Going from the first base side against righties, like, it gives me more room to work with,
yeah,
for sure, in terms of arm side and glove side. Like, I can, I feel that it helps me, you know, tunnel breaking balls.
Mm-hmm. Is it, do you even adjust that game to game, or is it always, like, in this one specific spot?
Yeah, I adjust, but, you know, that's another feel thing, too.
Right, yeah, totally. And just what is your approach to AAA in general? I mean, every game here is, in theory, a major league audition. I know they're building you up innings-wise and pitches-wise, but what is it to feel like to be one step away here?
Obviously, it's cool. You know, it's a dream come true to be a big leaguer in the first place, so just looking forward to that day. But just trying to get as much out of being here as possible. You know, and just learn from every outing. And that's, you know, that's the goal, whether I'm in the big leagues or here, low A, or college, like, wherever. I want to learn as much from every outing as possible to get me to the point where I can, you know, pitch in the big leagues for a long time and be, you know, really good there. So that's the goal there, is just trying to keep my eyes on what I'm trying to do, you know, at the end of the day, and figure out what I need to do here to make that happen.
Yeah, and just going back to what you were saying about the fastball in terms of being big and strong, when did you hit your growth spurt?
Really, it started my freshman, sophomore year of high school.
Okay.
And I probably grew like 4 or 5 inches throughout my sophomore year. Put on a bunch of weight that year too, and I've put on a lot of weight since then also. So it's been a constant thing of just growing in my body.
Yeah. Is that when you started to feel like you were blowing past guys as you were adding height and weight, or was that just what you were doing in middle school?
I mean, I started adding height and weight, and I still felt like I was behind guys. So, yeah, I don't know. Really growing in my body and figuring out how to move. I think that's a combination. And then what allows me to stay on the field and kind of do what I do is being strong and moving efficiently also.
Yeah, and just to end on this one, going back to what we were talking about before,
being a catcher, but also just your start at Air Force. How much did getting 2 years in the academy and under, you know, learning leadership under that way, how did you feel like that's set you up for your career?
It's been huge. And I met some of the greatest people I've ever gonna meet in my life when I was there too. And a lot of the lessons that I learned there, I might not even remember them, but I learned them and I think they're part of me now. So just super grateful for that experience. Because it taught me a lot about myself, taught me a lot about other people and how to be, you know, part of a team, how to lead, how to follow, all that. Two tough years, but probably two of the best years of my life of being there.
All right, great. That's all I have. Thanks so much, Paul. I really
appreciate
it.
Thanks
to Sam Dykstra and Paul Skeens. Great stuff there. Fascinating listen. We'll take a quick break and we'll be right back with the MLB Pipeline Podcast.
Okay, thanks to Sam Dykstra and Paul Skeens. Very illuminating interview. It's always interesting to me when the guys who are that talented just have to have, they have such a great understanding of what they're doing too. He's not just going out there and making it up as he goes along. Like there's thought behind it. So that was really interesting. Now let's switch gears, Jonathan. You and I are both spending a lot of time working on the draft top 150 list. We're updating, we're expanding. We're recording this on Tuesday morning. We have, I don't want to think about how many reports we have left to write.
Yeah, please
and,
don't.
And video voiceovers to record. But it is exciting to be diving back into the draft. Getting, you know, we're about 2 months into the college season, I guess, at this point. Anyway, so putting away the blurbs we have to write, not thinking about those. Interesting draft. Very, I think, top heavy in terms of college position players, the clear strength of the draft. I'm going to ask you, I'm going to interview you here, Jonathan.
All right.
How many legitimate candidates do you think there are for the Guardians? I didn't say Indians. I said Guardians. For the Guardians with the number one overall pick. How many guys you think, like, and I'm not saying they're, you know, I'm saying when it comes down to making the decision, I'm sure they're keeping options open right now because we still have 3 months before the draft. But legitimately, in your mind, how many candidates do you think belong in that discussion?
First of all, I like that you have to continue to pat yourself on the back for getting it right.
You're talking about the guy who
oh, I know.
As we talked, practiced Jack Caglione's name. We both had it down, and then I called him Caglione while we were talking.
I meant the Cleveland team name.
No, I knew what you meant. Like that's what I'm saying.
That curse jar is filled for the amount of times.
I will refer to them as the Indians at some point. Yes. Just like I keep referring to Jack.
Right. So to your question, I would say if I'm going to be sort of liberal and say 5, and I don't know that I really believe it's really 5, but I do think. I mean, I think the obvious that, you know, there's as you said, the top of the draft is very college heavy, as one scouting director wanted to trademark it, calling it the College Eight. so if you give a little tease as to what the top eight is going to look like, I'm not saying what order, but yes, college guys. I'm going to say that Charlie Condon from Georgia, Jack Caglione from Florida, Travis Bazana from Oregon State, Nick Kurtz from Wake Forest. And then I'm going to throw in Hagan Smith from Arkansas, just because I think teams always want to have an arm that they're going to consider. I don't know if Braden Montgomery has worked his way into like the real conversation. And I don't know that it's that wide of a net. I mean, that would be 6. What do you think, Jim?
Yeah, and it's, you know, I think, you know, J.J. Weatherholt, who was number one on our list coming into the year, you know, everybody was curious to see how he's going to look at shortstop, and he's had persistent hamstring injuries, and you haven't gotten a read on that. I think all that makes sense. I think if you're going to be liberal, I don't consider myself conservative, but I'm probably
moderate.
Less liberal. I'm less liberal than you. No, I consider myself a liberal, but I think it's fair to say I'm less liberal than you. Like
fair.
If you are. Are you an 80 liberal? Now we're going to get in trouble.
But no, like, let's move
you're
away.
You're probably an 80 liberal, and I'm a 60 liberal. Anyway, if we're on the spectrum. But anyway, aside from that, I think it's the 3 guys for the most part. Like what happens when Jason's gone? Like, he's never going to get a Paris again. Anyway, I've gotten way off track here. I think it comes down to three guys in the end. I think it's Charlie Condon, you know, Georgia outfielder, third baseman, you know, Jack Caglione, got his name right again. I'll pat myself on the back. First base left-hander, but I think it more as a hitter out of Florida, and then Travis Bazan to second base for Oregon State. Like Kurtz, I think Kurtz is very good. I think it'd be hard to take Kurtz over Condon and Caglione.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Corner profile, there's some like not like he's had injury issues here and there going back to high school. So I think the medical would be a little bit of a question. I'm with you. Like Brayden Montgomery has had a great year, but I think he's like a slight notch behind the big three.
I agree. I think that's right.
And I think your point about Hagen Smith, and you could throw Chase Burns in there too, because there's some people who like Burns more than Smith. Hagen Smith, the Arkansas lefty, Chase Burns, the Wake Forest righty. But yeah, like I'm sure if you're Cleveland, you're not like, and I'm sure at this point, honestly, they're probably looking at eight or nine guys. Like,
yeah,
I don't think Connor Griffin.
Right, the proverbial kicking the tires.
Yeah, you're keeping everything open. And then you narrow it as it gets closer. But I think, so when we get to the end, I think it's probably going to come down to Condon, Caglione, and Bazana. Now, I have another question for you. I'll be curious about your answer for this. Because I've talked to two or three people about this, and we kind of had a consensus. I wish I had the time, which I don't right now. Let's say we took the time, Jonathan, and we surveyed all 30 teams, and they gave you an honest answer. There's no posturing, just... who do you think is the best player in the draft? You know, money aside, you know, who would you take number one if you could have any player? How many teams out of 30 do you think would say Charlie Condon?
That's a very good question. And again, we don't know the answer to it, right?
We don't know the answer. It's just speculating.
Especially based on the year that he's had, but there's not a huge consensus. I'm going to say a majority, but not a super majority. I'm going to say 19.
Okay, that's interesting because I said 20.
Okay.
The person who, like, I had a guy with the team pose this question to me, and he thought it might be closer to 24 or 25.
Wow.
And then I was talking to somebody else about it, and without telling him my number or the other team official's number, and this guy loves Charlie Condon, so he clearly would take Charlie Condon. He said 20, and he said, nah, it's probably closer to 24 or 25. So it's funny, I was sitting there, and I don't know if you're having the same thought. It's like, oh, that would be a really cool story to do, but maybe later. We have time. We
yeah,
have
let's get the 150 out, and then we can do that.
I don't have time to try to get 30. And I think we could probably get somebody from each team to play along with us.
I think so.
Anyway, it'll be interesting. We may have to do that story and come out with that number. He's having an amazing year, and you know, because he's a Bulldog, I have to repeat my love for my alma mater that if he does go number one, Georgia would join LSU as the only schools to have a number one pick in baseball, basketball, and football. So you're going to hear that a few more times, Jonathan.
I can't wait.
Yep. We'll pull that out, I'm sure, on the broadcast at some point, too. Maybe even day two broadcast. I'll bring it up in the fifth round just for fun. We will move on. So we don't want to give away the rankings, which, to be honest, we're still tweaking a little bit. They're not 100% finalized. Anyway, so we were not going to give them to you. We couldn't really give you final official rankings, but I thought it might be fun just as a way to tease the rankings, and we're not going to, you know, give you labored analysis. Well, we might be labored because we're tired, but we aren't going to give you overly detailed analysis of each guy. We're going to have full scouting reports on the website, but I thought it'd be fun to go down top player, each position, and we'll see if we agree. And I'm actually going to put you on the spot because I think this might be the hardest one of all, Jonathan, but I'm going to let you start with catcher. Who do you think is the best catcher in the draft?
It's not a great year. I think coming into the year, it probably would have been between Caleb Lomavita from Cal and then staying in North Carolina, Malcolm Moore from Stanford. Malcolm Moore has had a bad year. People who like him think that it's kind of running into bad luck. The metrics and the data are still there. He's still hitting the ball hard. The catching has improved. But, you know, he's hitting like 200, you know, at a certain point in time, that matters, right? So, yep. So I'm going to say Caleb Lomavita from Cal. I'll give the edge. You know, there are people a little concerned. He is a little bit of a free swinger, but he has been performing. So that will be my pick.
And I would agree with that. I've heard the same things on Malcolm Moore. I will throw in real quick my sleeper catcher, Walker Yannick of Sam Houston, could make a run at Caleb Lomavita by the time we get to July. But I agree with that. At first base, you know, it's two of the probably five best players in the draft. I think it's a pretty easy decision. I'm going to pick, and pronounce his name correctly, Jack Caglione over Nick Kurtz. And it's hard. I need to give myself positive reinforcement, so I keep doing it.
Sure, that's fair.
But I was going to say, the thing that's really impressed me about Jack Caglione, like, we knew he had power, led the nation of homers last year, you know, also very talented pitcher. I think he's getting drafted as a hitter. But the big concern coming into the year was that he chases a ton and he strikes out a lot. But he is really, his strikeout rate, I think, is 13%. He's really cut it. And I'm very, very impressed at the adjustments he's made when he was going to be a high pick, even if he'd been the same guy he was last year. So to me, Jonathan, I've got Caglione, Nick Kurtz, a close second.
Yeah.
It's a good year for first baseman.
Yeah, it is. I think that's fine. And, you know, if somehow you're only drafting first baseman and you're picking number two, you're not going to be upset. And if Caglione goes one, you get Kurtz, fine.
Yep.
All right. Second base, there are some options. And I think heading into the year, this probably would have been closer. But given J.J. Weatherholt's issues with his hamstrings and the injuries, he hasn't been seen at short, but most people saw him as a second base. Travis Bazan is the obvious choice. He's having an absolutely bonkers year. The numbers don't even make sense when you look at them. He's, you know, hitting for average. He's driving the ball, the power. He's running. You know, there's a reason why, even though he's, you know, a slightly undersized second baseman, why he's very much in the conversation for number one overall pick.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I think that one, that's a pretty easy one. And the last time I looked, I think his on base percentage was 600 or 598.
It's like stupid.
It's ridiculous. So third base is kind of tough because I'm not going to cheat because I think most people think Charlie Condon's an outfielder and not third baseman. So I'm not going to cheat and take Charlie Condon.
Save him for outfield. That's okay.
Yeah, I'm not going to make my life easier by doing that. You know, Seaver King has wound up at third base for Wake Forest. You have Billy Amick, who's having a great year at Tennessee, had appendicitis. Tommy White, who we ranked ahead of those two guys coming into the year, hasn't had quite the same year. I guess it's Seaver King, but I think that's one where you could talk to three different teams and get three different answers, and you might get a little Cam Smith from Florida State thrown in there as well, or if you want to throw Kalen Culpepper, who's playing short but winds up at third eventually at K-State. But I will pick Seaver King. I don't think Seaver King, that's his best position as a pro, but that's where he's playing now. I backed myself into the corner. Third, I should have taken the easy way out. I did not, but I will pick Seaver King and kind of shrug. You could talk me into a number of guys there.
I'm the same. You put their names in a hat and pick one out. Kind of thing, and I think you'd be okay in making an argument. But I think Seaver King makes the most sense. Shortstop, we finally can talk about high schoolers. I think this one is interesting because I think there are two choices now. There's Connor Griffin in your neck of the draft.
Yep.
Probably the most exciting tool set of anyone. Period, you know, in terms of ceiling,
yeah,
you know, obviously a little more raw, things like that. And then there's Bryce Rayner from Harvard Westlake in California, who we've talked about, you know, after the NHSI, as a guy who's moved way up into the, you know, top of the first round sort of stratosphere with how he's performed this spring. I'm going to take Rayner only because there is a better chance we're going to see him play shortstop. And I know that Connor Griffin can play shortstop. I just think you put him in center field and let the tools and the athleticism play. Rainer was a guy who he's kind of transformed who he is. He looks like a man amongst boys, sort of in a Corey Seager kind of way. Big, strong left-handed hitter. He's got power. He can really play shortstop and is going to stay there a long time. And maybe it's familiarity bias, my neck of the draft, and I just saw him be the best prospect at NHSI, but that's who I would take.
Yeah, I mean, that's all fair.
By position.
Yeah, by position. I would probably take Connor Griffin, but it's going to be interesting. I mean, he could get sent out as a center fielder. It's like he has a chance to be a plus shortstop. He has a chance to be like a gold glove center fielder. So I would take Connor Griffin, although acknowledging that I might be cheating because I'm not sure he's definitely getting sent out as a shortstop. But
that's not cheating. I mean, you're saying he should be sent out as a shortstop. Why not see what it looks like? They could always pull an Adam Jones and move him out to center and let him go get it out there.
Yeah, I think that's. Yeah, exactly. So anyway, I will take Connor Griffin. Outfield is easy because I left myself Charlie Condon. And I think one of the things that's helped his draft profile even more this year is, you know, he came into the year, he played mostly first. He's played center. He's played the corners. He's played third base. I think he has an outside chance of being that he could maybe be a big league third baseman, although he's so big. And I think it's just, you're going to put this guy in the outfield. You know, he's leading the nation in hitting. He's leading the nation in slugging. He's slugging 1119, Jonathan, which would be a good ops.
Yeah.
He's leading the nation in homers. He's second to the aforementioned Travis Bazan on base percentage. Travis has slumped down to 590 now. But I would take Charlie Condon. And also I will tip my proverbial cap to Brayden Montgomery. Both these guys were on the podcast recently. We had Brayden on last week. Brayden Montgomery's had an unbelievable year and getting overshadowed a little bit, but you know, Brayden Montgomery is probably going to be a top five pick in the draft. He's having a great year in the outfield as well.
Yeah, no, it is an embarrassment of riches in terms of who to pick there. So well done. So what do we have left? Just, we're going to pick one pitcher.
Well, yeah, just one pitcher is all you need.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, again, I think it comes down to two players. Hagen Smith, the lefty from Arkansas, and Chase Burns, the righty from Wake Forest. We've talked about both of them. You know, Burns, from a pure stuff standpoint, that's the end of the discussion. Not that Hagen Smith's stuff is bad, but, like, Burns is electric. And he's done a much, much better job of throwing strikes this year with the move to Wake Forest. And, I'm a little bit more of a believer in him, but Hagen Smith has, as Scott will say, has posted every week and has been absolutely ridiculously dominant, you know, left-handed. So I think if I'm only picking one, I would take Hagen Smith, but I might want to try to pull a Jim Callis and say, well, we need one lefty and one righty and take both of them.
No, you can't do that.
All right, so I'll take Hagen Smith.
But I will concur with you. I mean, I think they're neck and neck. It feels like a lot of the media lists have Burns ahead of Smith, and I don't think it's a landslide, but talking to teams, I think at least the teams I've talked to have Smith slightly ahead of Burns. Like, and you have to nitpick to separate them. I mean, Hagen is left-handed. I think he doesn't throw as hard as Chase Burns, but I think his fastball actually plays better. I think he's a little more physical. It's a better delivery. I mean, I'm nitpicking. It's not like Chase Burns is terrible in any of those regards. But I will concur with you, and I would go Hagen Smith over Chase Burns. So there's a little sneak peek. I think we did a nice job there. I'm just going to pat myself on the back.
He's doing a lot of self-congratulations today, which is fine.
I think I'm compensating because we opened by talking about your 25-year career,
man.
And what a cool feat that is. So like I'm like subconsciously I matter too. No, anyway, that's not really what's happening. But anyway, we're getting giddy here because we're tired because of the draft top 150. And we're gonna wrap this up now with a question from our listener mailbag. Several fine questions, and I will give you the question. And then it required some research, which I only partially completed, but we're going to, I will figure out the answer. I'll probably use this question in the pipeline inbox later this week, and I will get a definitive answer on what the record that we're talking about is. Anyway, the question from Ed Casey at Casey W Sox. He's a White Sox fan. Always, you probably had inbox questions from Ed.
Yes.
Fine podcast listener, fine inbox reader.
So thank you to Ed. He has another good question this week. Hi, Jim and Jonathan. Do you think this draft will have the fewest high schoolers drafted in the first round since you both have been covering the draft? And so the question that immediately jumps to mind is, what would that record be? I believe, I wasn't able to work my way all the way back, but looking at some old Baseball America almanacs where we would list the players, not for the complete draft, but for various years, how many high school, college, et cetera. I believe the lowest number in draft history, regardless of whether you are covering it, is 9. There were 9 high school first rounders in 2008. So the question is, do you think we will have fewer than 9 high school players taken in the first round this year?
I'm going to say yes, but I'm hesitating.
I'm on the fence on it as well.
Because, you know, I think the interesting thing is that there are some good, there's some decent high school pitching in this class, but yep. That's such a risky bucket to draft from. But given that this draft class, especially after you get past the College 8 trademarked, there are a lot of question marks. Maybe teams will decide to take the high school arm that they find really intriguing when they wouldn't do that, you know, in other years. And so that could up the total a little bit more. But I do think then when push comes to shove, tendency, like when it's time to kind of make that decision, the sort of fear around the demographic of high school pitching, especially high school right-handers, will mitigate that. So I will say it's going to be right around that. I'm going to say 8 or 9.
Yeah, I know. I feel like if you were setting the over-under, like, and you weren't trying to put it on a half, like, I feel like 9 would be the number to pick, because I guess I would lean, and I'm with you. I'm just so on the fence with this. I guess if I had to pick, I will pick the under just barely. I'll say we'll have 8, because I think Connor Griffin and Bryce Rayner, who we just talked about, they're definitely going in the first round.
Yes.
You look at the position players. I think Slade Caldwell goes in the first round. It's not a big physical guy, but I think Slade Caldwell probably goes in the first round. That's 3. And then you have pop-up guys like Theo Gillen and Kellen Lindsay. Maybe Wyatt Sanford. I don't think he's quite a first rounder, but Gillen and Lindsay. So I could get to 5 position players. And then, like you mentioned, you have the high school pitchers. William Schmidt, probably first rounder. Cam Caminiti, you get some diverse opinions on him.
Yeah.
I'd say probable first rounder, but I wouldn't say lock. And then you have guys like Ryan Sloan and Cash Mayfield would be the other 2 high school pitchers in the first round. Maybe some guys will make a push. But the thing is, the way this draft always works, or usually works, is your best high school pitchers, they get first round money, but they don't get it in the first round. So to get to 9, I have to have those 5 hitters and all 4 of those pitchers go in the first round. And I feel like somebody's going to push those pitchers to the sandwich or second round and pay them there. So you know what? I'm going to say the under, but it's going to be close. I think it's going to be close.
Yeah, I think you've nailed it.
So Ed with a very, thanks to Ed. That's a tremendous question, because I don't know, we have the questions usually cause us that much angst, Jonathan.
Well, it's good to have a debate.
But it was a good question. Like, you really had to think about it. And I will delve more into that in the pipeline inbox. I am guaranteeing right now that question will be in the pipeline inbox. But anyway, plenty of stuff coming out on the site this week. Draft Top 150 will come out. This podcast should go live Tuesday night. Draft Top 150 will come out tomorrow. Look for Jonathan's story, the Justin's 20 years later. Go read Sam's story on Paul Skeens if you haven't read it already. Great stuff there. Anyway, that's a wrap for this week's MLB Pipeline podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you might get your podcasts, so you don't miss an episode. And if you're enjoying the show or have any suggestions, leave us a rating, leave us a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.